Hello, I'm Fred Stella, president of the Interfaith Dialogue Association. Welcome to another edition of Common Threads. Last week, we began our conversation with Kenneth Womack on the spirituality of the Beatles, their take on organized religion, and all sorts of other fun, fab things. Briefly, Kenneth Womack is a world-renowned authority on the Beatles and their enduring cultural influence. His latest book project involves a two-volume, full-length biography devoted to famed Beatles producer Sir George Martin. Forthcoming in 2017, the first book in the series will be entitled Maximum Volume, The Life of Beatles Producer George Martin, The Early Years, 1926 to 1966. Ken's Beatles-related books include Long and Winding Roads, Evolving Artistry of the Beatles, and The Cambridge Companion to the Beatles, which was named the Independent Music Book of the Year. And he is Dean of the McMurray School of Humanities and Social Sciences at Monmouth University in New Jersey, where he also serves as a professor of English. We welcome once again to Common Threads, Kenneth Womack. Hello, Professor.
Thanks so much, Fred. It's good to be back.
Certainly, certainly. So last week, if people missed it, we spent a good deal of time talking about the controversies that were engendered, particularly by John Lennon, about his take on Christianity and the Beatles, and other thoughts as well. But one of the most important aspects of the spiritual lives of the Beatles was their introduction to Eastern spirituality. That included the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi and transcendental meditation to at least a couple of them. John and George come to mind. I don't know so much about Paul and Ringo here, but their introduction to the Hare Krishna movement and the guru of that particular Vaishnav sect, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami. And what I find interesting, Ken, is that my understanding is that even till today, the surviving Beatles, Paul and Ringo, still maintain at least a pied-à-terre in that world. Am I correct?
You know, I can't speak with any specificity on that. I know Paul still refers to, certainly to their sojourn, to Rishikesh. It was very important for George Harrison, of course. I think part of his ashes were scattered in the Ganges, if I'm correct. But it was, you know, it's one of the great stories of the Beatles, isn't it? That at the height of their fame, they decide, you know, we're going to seek out enlightenment. Perhaps it's a natural human response, and I'm not giving it enough credit, but to me it is just an amazing moment that they make that choice. And they do it 50 years ago, right? During the Summer of Love, when their world is in turmoil. In fact, for George Martin, some of the toughest times to work with the Beatles were right after Sgt. Pepper came out. They were a little at sea, and they right their ship a little bit when they first hear the Maharishi speak at the London Hilton and then follow him up to Wales, and then later, of course, go to India.
And, of course, they write a tremendous amount of songs at the ashram in Rishikesh. They are able to socialize with other celebrities, including rock and roll folks at the ashram. Now, here's something. I'm wondering what your take on this is, because for years, for 50 years, we heard that the Beatles left the Maharishi's ashram because he was accused of inappropriate behavior with women. But I read a book by a woman who was there. Help me with her name if you remember it. She is the woman who's actually the mother of Bungalow Bill.
You're absolutely right.
And she says that wasn't true. Do we have any clearer observations of?
No, it was definitively untrue, and she's absolutely right. I've met her. That's Nancy Cook de Herrera, and I know her because, and this comes under the small world heading, I studied Russian language and literature for many years with her other son, Bill's older brother, Brett. And at first he would joke about his brother from the famous Beatles song, and as a lifelong Beatle fan at that point, I would think, oh, whatever, you know, that's just Professor Cook being silly again. But he was the guy, and John Lennon especially marveled at Bungalow Bill's sort of idiocy, right?
Yes.
At his brother at bringing a gun to shoot a tiger, and what a horrible thing that was in that moment. So, but it absolutely was untrue. The Maharishi had really been maligned unfairly, and that was at the hands, quite frankly, of a guy named Magic Alex. You may be aware of Magic Alex. Alex was the crackpot inventor with whom John Lennon had become friends, and he really used to listen to Magic Alex to his peril. Magic Alex would create a number of really awful moments for the Beatles. Another one occurred when he would spread rumors after John and Cynthia broke up that he had had an affair with Cynthia, and he would tell John this. And he would do these things, by the way, to try to firm up his relationship with Lennon and protect that that place for himself in the Beatles' inner circle. It was really atrocious, his behavior. But in any event, it was completely made up. The Maharishi, being a holy man and a man who chose his words very carefully, didn't spend a lot of time denying it because, to his mind, it was ludicrous, right? But ultimately, some years later, George Harrison, when he had fully learned this, apologized to the Maharishi, who refused to accept their apology, by the way. He said, "You don't need to apologize to me. You are angels in disguise," is how he famously responded to Harrison, letting him know that apologies weren't necessary. He had never doubted them or their importance in his world or what they had taken away from their weeks and days at the ashram.
So when they recorded Sexy Sadie, they were still under the impression that he was quite fallible.
Absolutely. And, at first John was going to call it Maharishi. Now, think about this for a moment. John was probably engaged in a little too much hero Welsh worship on his own, right? He had elevated the Maharishi to quite a level. At one point, he even joked about how he wanted to stay there and live in India. I don't know if he was joking. I think he was half serious. He felt comfortable there and imagined it a place where he could live out his future. So, it was certainly about the Maharishi. Fortunately, they talked him out of calling the song Maharishi, and it has a kind of larger meaning, like most of the best Beatles songs, right? It's really no longer about that. It's about illusion and cultural, fallacy, that sort of thing. Like a lot of the best Beatles songs, it becomes elevated.
Yes. Then, after their stint with the Maharishi, as I said, at least two of them, George and John, form a relationship with the Hare Krishna movement. Certainly, it's much stronger with George, but John ends up hosting devotees in his home for a while before, he decides that isn't the wisest thing to do. Let's talk about that portion.
Right, and it's almost a footnote, that moment, but it does happen, and it demonstrates how once they'd returned from the mountains of Rishikesh, the search was not over, right? I suppose, to quote you too, they still hadn't found what they were looking for, right? And the exploration was only just beginning. And John was, of course, still asking questions until his last hours on Earth. So certainly, that was part of their exploration. Like many people, they left the 1960s dissatisfied that the utopian dream had not changed the world. So I think what that shows us more than anything else is that they were still looking, like so many who had followed them in the 1960s, they were still looking for their own kind of answers.
And then There's a lot of vagueness, if you will. People who were continuing to look to the Beatles separately, and of course, a lot of us in our heads, we never really completely separated them, and they never really completely separated themselves. Even during their solo ventures, there was an awful lot of after the legal stuff was more or less taken care of. Right, you had them guest starring on one another's albums, and you know, you saw that there was still this Beatles family out there. I noticed that there was this sort of vagueness of spirituality with most of them, except for George, who was accused of being a little bit too heavy-handed. Let's talk about that part of history.
I think George went into a kind of malaise, I suppose, is one way to put it, at a certain point in the 70s. You know, he had risen to such heights with that great solo album, the best solo album of the Beatles, All Things Must Pass. Living in the Material World also had some high points. He went on tour. And really, I don't know how to put it without sounding flip, but he went off the deep end a little bit, and began to refashion some of their lyrics. He did In My Life, the Lennon song, and he said, "In my life, I love God more." You know, he was beginning to proselytize in ways that the Beatles really had not. And then his first marriage, of course, gets into very serious trouble with infidelity on both of their parts. And after many years of throwing off drugs, he's returning some of the old addictions again. So George really was in a tough place that fortunately he came out of. But if, like all of us, right, even though he didn't live a very long life, across his life he had many ups and downs, and there was certainly one in there where he was lost again. In fact, just a few days ago, a little quiz had come to light that John and Lennon had taken, a word association quiz. An interviewer had gotten to him around 1975, 76, 77, somewhere in there, and asked him what he thought about various people in his life. And one of them said, you know, it said Ringo, and he said friend. And then they said Paul, and he said extraordinary. And they said George, and he said lost, which I think is quite interesting, was his read at that point on George Harrison.
That is, and certainly do you know the year of that quiz?
76, 77 maybe is what I'm believing I saw, but I immediately saved it to my camera reel. You know, it's the kind of thing that you want to look back on and think about.
Certainly, certainly. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Common Threads here on WGVU-FM. I'm Fred Stella, and with me today is Professor Kenneth Womack, and we're talking about the Beatles, religion, spirituality, etc., etc. And so let's talk about the latter days of John. So we see him go through just so many different stages. We see him go through his All You Need Is Love. We see him go through his Primal Scream era with the Plastic Ono Band album. We see him go through a real heavy leftist political era with sometime in New York City. And then we see him just really make great, great music, then retire, become a house husband, and then make one final splash before his untimely demise. What do we know about those missing years, those householder years or house husband years, and then his return to music, and specifically any form of spirituality that may have permeated those years?
Well, you know, certainly there is a lot of mythology about that period, including the house husband ecosystem that he and Yoko were sharing there toward the end. biographers have poked holes into that and shed light on how real or unreal that was. And I'll leave that to others. But I would take it with some skepticism. I think we probably still don't know the extent to which John had not gotten over his addictions by that point. You know, the heroin addiction that begins sometime in late 1968 is devastating for him, and it's hard to see if he ever really recovers from that. But certainly Double Fantasy was a kind of breath of fresh air. And, of course, we're all horribly denied the opportunity to see how his career would have played out from that point forward. He was certainly excited about this next phase of his career. That exuberance is just incredibly evident throughout his interviews. You can even hear it in the last waning moments of his famous interview with Dave Sholin on the afternoon of December 8th with his killer just outside. He is just audibly excited about where he is in life. And, you know, it's heartbreaking to listen to it now. And he's actually audibly, according to Dave Sholin, not on recording, excited about the other Beatles, too, and about who they are and his love for them. But, you know, going back to the spirituality, I'm not sure John had found those answers. He never liked overt religiosity, so when Dylan goes through his phase with Gotta Serve Somebody, John mocked that in some of his home recordings at the time. I think he found that to be troubling. He thought that that was more of an internal search that people should go on. You know, overall, a lot of critics like to liken the Beatles as being, what, postmodern, right? And I don't agree in the sense that postmodernists are often seen as being kind of nihilistic and not really having a moral center, which is a good way to understand the Beatles. They may not have been explicitly aligned with organized religion, but to say that they were atheistic is a mistake. That simply wasn't their culture, not for any of them, from my understanding. They believed in a moral center. They may have had postmodern experimentation on records like the White Album, for example, but they were modernists in the sense that they believed ultimately that there's a moral center. Often it's just our human community, right? And going back to where we started with the piece you had mentioned that I'd written, their issue was the failure when organized religion should step up and help everyone. You know, and namely, you can see this in songs like Eleanor Rigby and Lady Madonna. The Beatles did believe that we can get moral utility and, you know, humanistic value out of our communities, specifically our very local ones, our neighbors, our close friends, our families. And that to them was this kind of source of peace and love. And the great buoyant light for them about the 1960s would be this idea that there was this utopian community that we could form. They liked that idea. I don't know if I want to be with anybody who can't like the idea that perhaps there is a better human community for us out there. But they certainly believed in a moral center, even if it was perhaps more difficult to glimpse it at times in their music.
What would you say? We only have a few minutes left, but Kenneth, what would you say would be some of your favorite Beatles songs, both collective and solo? You can choose from a very, very wide canon here. What would you say some of your favorite songs are that express some kind of spirituality that may not be overt? You know, so don't say My Sweet Lord.
Well, and I just named two McCartney songs, of course, that probably are, for the Beatles, slightly on the overt side, Eleanor Rigby and Lady Madonna. But less overt, I immediately think about a couple of John Lennon songs. Well, Lennon and McCartney, in the case of a true collaboration, A Day in the Life, to me, is a very rich text if you want to understand the mid-60s Beatles, and really perhaps the philosophy that you see across their careers. A lot has been made about the phrase, "I'd love to turn you on," as though it's necessarily about acid or narcotics or something. When in the context of that song, A Day in the Life, it's about turning us on to, you know, looking away from groupthink and ignoring the needs of those who are less fortunate and banding together in a larger sense. I'd love to turn you on, and there's almost an ellipse there, right? But we don't. But I can't. And, of course, the song famously ends with that dark E chord that is fraught with problematic. It's a tough chord to listen to, very different from the C that ends their career on the end. Another great Lennon song, and it was one I was thinking of as we were talking just a few moments ago, is Number 9 Dream. Do you remember that one?
Oh, absolutely.
A beautiful song that is very, very spiritual. I've had the opportunity to speak with May Pang about, who was in John's life at that time. And he was turning a very important corner there. It would have been, if there's any if that I would want to play out, hypothetical in my mind, I would like to have seen John continuing in the vein in the 70s and perhaps not retreating, but maybe exploring some of the places he was starting to go with the Walls and Bridges album. And certainly with that song, there is a positivism about serenity, even an apology to George that takes place in that song. John knew that he had missed George some years ago when he didn't participate in the concert for Bangladesh. But in any event, there's a lot of beauty there that underscores the kind of etherealism that they would espouse in terms of religion. Give Me Love, Give Me Peace on Earth is probably an easy choice, but it's a great example of George Harrison at his finest and espousing that kind of need to celebrate inner peace and love. And with a kind of musical unity, and when I say musical unity, I mean the lyrics match the music, right? The tonality of the music fits the expression that is being offered in the words.
And another one that comes to mind is Here Comes the Moon.
Sure.
Everybody talks about Here Comes the Sun. Well, of course, Here Comes the Sun. I mean, both Here Comes the Moon and Here Comes the Sun. Now, most people don't know Here Comes the Moon. But I am really, really affected by that.
Absolutely. And, you know, it doesn't get a lot of play, but in an important song for Lennon and McCartney, because Paul was trying to say something very concrete. And in the song Let Me Roll It from Band on the Run, he says, you know, my heart is like a wheel. Let me roll it to you. You know, Paul had learned some hard lessons in his waning days with the Beatles about regret, and how we can create heartbreak in others, and after we do, it's hard to do anything about it. You know, my favorite McCartney moment in the Beatles is in the song Carry That Weight, recognizing that we can do things that are very hard to get over. You will carry that weight a long time. And he has a revelation that he offers in that song, maybe his finest lyrics for my money. I never give you my pillow. Remember that?
Yes,
of course. It's a very powerful line because it's easily interpreted to be, I don't provide you with consolation or comfort. And it's a recognition in his voice and in his words and in the music that he knew he could have. He chose not to provide comfort and consolation. And, you know, that's a terrible realization to make about yourself. So there's a lot of wisdom in that music that we can take that's not overt about religion or spirituality or anything of that nature, that are simply good life lessons, right? And I try to underscore those moments when I'm teaching the Beatles. Think about the gravity of what he's saying when he says, I never give you my pillow. It's a recognition that he could have done something to comfort his fellow humans, and he didn't.
You just brought up your course on the Beatles, and before we actually went on the air, I asked you a question, but I will share it with those who are with us now. You say it's still a very popular course.
Right. I had begun a course at Penn State introducing the Beatles, and my colleagues there still run it. We have a very popular course here, too, that my colleague Ken Campbell operates out of our history department. they are more popular than ever on college campuses. And
wait a minute. More popular than Jesus?
No, I just said than ever. That would be for others to decide, but they are more popular than ever. And when we run a course, it fills up. Students today may not know a lot about, they may not know who Jack Ruby is, right? But
yes,
they know who the Beatles are, and they are always eager to learn more about them.
That's very exciting to know. It's when you go to a Ringo or a McCartney concert these days, when you see, 12-year-olds there with their 70-year-old grandparents, it's just so exciting. Yeah, that it is so timeless.
You can draw a line from the image you just described to 1965, right? 1964, the Beatles come over here. Their demographic is teeny boppers. 1965, they start doing songs like Yesterday and In My Life, Norwegian Wood, then later Eleanor Rigby, Hey Jude, etc. They take that demographic, which is fairly narrow, and they blow it up. Right? They take that thing and they expand it from after Yellow Submarine, it's 5 years old to 105. And it still persists today. It's for those of you who study brand marketing, there's a lesson in there somewhere. I'm not the one to articulate it, but they do something there that is really deft.
Indeed. Could not have said it better. But then again, I'm not paid to say things better. Kenneth, it has just been a joy to have you here both today and last week as well.
Oh, well, thanks so much. It's been a great pleasure. Thanks so much, Fred.
Certainly. And KennethWomack.com is the place people can find out more about you and your books, right?
Absolutely. Please check me out. I've got the first George Martin biography for major release on September 1st. Hope you'll give it a chance.
Indeed. Just like peace.
That's right.
This is Common Threads here on WGVU, and I'm going to stop because I could do a whole lot more of that. Please join us again next week on Common Threads.